Okay, I'm going to be talking about some, actually by this point these results are not completely new. They're, the most recent results are almost a year old now. The work I'm going to be talking about is joint work with Mark Johnson and David McCloskey. David is in the back of the room here, so this is his work as well. So I'm going to start by talking about first some very old parsing results, i.e. they go back to 1990. Then I'm going to be talking about some recent but still old results, 2004 to 2005. And then I'm going to be talking about some 2006 results. So first of all, what is parsing? Parsing is a process by which you take a string of words, a sentence, here Alice ate yellow squash, and you produce a syntactic tree. And here the syntactic tree says that we've got a sentence, it has a noun phrase NP and a verb phrase VP. The noun phrase consists of a single noun N, which is Alice. The verb phrase is a verb a verb phrase is a verb followed by a noun phrase, and the noun phrase here is an adjective, yellow, and then squash. And that's the sort of thing we expect to get from a parser. Why do we care about parsing? Well, we care about parsing because parsing gives us the first rough cut at how the sentence is built up, how the meaning of the entire sentence is built up out of the meaning of its parts. So in particular, consider the example, in the hotel, fake property was sold to tourists, and you could ask a question like, what does fake modify? Well, if this were French, where we know that adjectives typically come after the nouns that they modify, fake might modify hotel. So it would be a fake hotel. In fact, this is English, so it's property, so it's fake property. And again, the only way you can know this is by knowing the grammar of English, and then by applying that grammar to this particular sentence to infer that relationship between those two words. Similarly, what does in the hotel modify? Well, again, if you didn't know anything, you say, well, maybe the property's in the hotel. Okay. Or again, maybe it was the selling that was in the hotel. Well, again, if you know anything about English, you know that it has to be the selling that's taking place there, simply because there's a rule in English that if you take a prepositional phrase like in the hotel and move it to the front of the sentence, that prepositional phrase has to be modifying the verb. It can't be modifying an interior noun phrase. So, again, if we want to be able to infer these relationships and thus be able to build up the meaning of the whole out of the meaning of the parts, we need to know syntax, and we need to be able to apply syntax in a process of parsing in order to get these relationships. Now, what makes parsing difficult is ambiguity. A given sentence can have many possible parses. So here's a very simple one. Salesman sold the dog biscuits. On the left, we have a single noun phrase, which is the dog biscuits, and that's what the salesman sold. Okay. On the right, we have two noun phrases. And just to emphasize this, I will just rephrase the sentence. Salesman sold the dog biscuits. Okay, and here that's quite clearly meaning salesman sold the biscuits to the dog. The string is identical, but the meaning is different, and the parse is different. Okay, so what makes parsing difficult is ambiguity. Namely, given a string, there is not, in general, not a unique parse that can be assigned to that string, and our problem then is to figure out which one is the correct parse, i.e. the one that the speaker or author intended. Now, in this particular case, both of the possible parses have meanings associated with them. Often they won't. Often they'll just be parses that are legal according to some abstract grammar, but that you could never actually say. They wouldn't be meaningful. Okay, so for example, here, there's one that's just sort of barely meaningful. The salesman sold the dog biscuits, where you have two noun phrases in a row, but you don't, but they are part of a single noun phrase. As in, the salesman sold the dog Rex, where Rex is the name of the dog. Okay, so maybe biscuits is the name of the dog. You can see how these things can get, you know, more and more distant from a plausible sentence, but in general, a given sentence may have billions and billions of possible parses. Most of them will be completely meaningless, but nevertheless, they are licensed by the grammar and thus, in some sense, have to be rejected. So how do you go about deciding which is the intended parse and which isn't? Well, the way that modern statistical parsers approach this problem is by viewing it as a one of probability. Namely, we will say what we want to do is not find a parse or all the possible parses, but rather find the most probable parse. And how might we do that? Well, in one very common way of doing it is using what is called a probabilistic context-free grammar, or a PCFG. And a PCFG is simply a context-free grammar, which is a context-free grammar, as you may remember, is simply a series of rewrite rules of the form, in this particular case, sentence goes to noun phrase, verb phrase goes to verb, noun phrase. And here, this is obviously just a very small grammar, and the only thing it can derive pretty much is the sentence, is the tree on the right-hand side. And what we, it's called context-free, by the way, because the symbols on the left don't require any special context. They just say anytime you see a verb phrase, it can be replaced by a verb followed by a noun phrase. And this kind of grammar is very well known in both computational linguistics and in computer science. A probabilistic context-free grammar is simply a context-free grammar in which every rewrite rule has a probability, and this probability is to be interpreted as the probability that if we are going to replace, say, a verb phrase with subconstituents, what is the probability we will use this replacement rule rather than some others? And as such, the sum of the probabilities for all left-hand sides has to sum to one. So in this particular very simple grammar, there are only three nouns, and so the probability of the total of three nouns has to sum to one. In a realistic grammar, of course, we're not going to have, what is it, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 rules as in this artificial grammar, but we might have something on the order of, 100,000 rules, say. By the way, if anyone has questions, feel free to ask. So, our basic paradigm that we're going to adopt looks like this. Namely, we have the so-called Penn tree bank, which I will be describing in a moment, that consists of 40,000 sentences that have been parsed by hand. And we're going to break this up into two parts. One is the training portion, and the other is the testing portion. Then we're going to take the training portion, and we're going to basically put it through what I grandiosely here called a learner. But all it's in fact going to do is collect statistics on the training portion, and I'll be showing you how that's done. It's very simple. Those statistics are then fed into a parser, which then applies those statistics to a new sentence. And in particular, so we are able to judge how well we're doing, we're going to take that new sentence from the testing portion. We're going to strip off the tree, just look at the yield, the actual words, feed that yield into the tester, we will get out a tree, and then we're going to compare that tree against what the tree bank says is correct, and we'll see how well we're doing. And so that's the basic paradigm for all the experiments that I'm going to be describing here. So as I said, what we're going to be using is the so-called Penn Wall Street Journal tree bank. It's about 1 million words. The average sentence length is 23 words in punctuation. This is the very first sentence of the what we call the training portion of the tree bank. It says, in an October 19th review of The Misanthrope at Chicago Goodman's Theater, Revitalized Classics Take the Stage in Windy City, Leisure and Arts, the role of Clementine, played by Kim Cattrall, was mistakenly attributed to Christina Haig. So you can see these are not your prototypical Jack gave Sue a book type sentences. These are the real things, full of real complexities, and in general, non-trivial. So I said that in what we are going to do is take the training portion and, quote, learn from it. And basically all that amounts to is we're going to go through the training portion of the tree bank and pull out what are called local trees. What is a local tree? A local tree is simply a symbol followed by its immediate descendants. So here we've got a local tree. S goes to noun phrase, verb phrase, period. And that becomes now one of the rules of our grammar. So that's it's very simple. And we're just going to go through everything and recursively do this all the way down. Here's another local tree. Verb phrase goes to verb noun phrase. And then we're going to count how often we have seen each one of these rules. And then we're going to assign a probability to each rule, which is the number which we're going to compute using the maximum likelihood estimate, which is simply the number of times we've seen that rule divided by the number of times we've seen any rule with the same left-hand side. Once we've done that, we now want to apply a parser and retrieve from this parser the single best parse, whereby best we mean most probable. So what we're trying to find is to find the most probable parse pi given the sentence S. Or to put this more formally, we want to find argmax pi, probability of pi given S. So the probability of pi given S is the probability of the parse given the sentence, and argmax pi simply says, give me the parse pi that maximizes that quantity. And that in turn, let's see, do I have some pointers here? That in turn is equal to simply the argmax pi of the joint probability. That's just some elementary probability theory. And if we restrict parses pi to those with whose yield is S, then we can just write that as that quantity. And for a PCFG, it turns out that quantity is very easy to calculate. Namely, we simply look at all the constituents in the parse, multiply all the rule probabilities together, and that gives us the probability of any particular parse. Okay. Any questions so far? How many people are with me? All my students say they're with me, okay. How many people aren't with me? Not everyone rose your hand. Okay. Can you explain anything I could have explained better? Okay, once more through the abbreviations. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to find the highest probability parse for this particular sentence, which another way of writing that is simply, so this is the probability of the parse given the sentence. We want to find the highest one, the one that is most probable. And the way we write that is argmax pi. So find the maximum pi, or find the pi that maximizes this, i.e., the most probable. So this is just a formal mathematical way of saying, give me the most probable parse. And then this is Bayes' law, basically. It says, if I were going to write this out more completely, it would say this is equal to the probability of pi and s divided by the probability of s. But we can ignore the probability of s because the sentence doesn't change. All we're going to do is change the parse. So then that's equal to this. And then since the parse includes the sentence, that's equivalent to that. And then this is just a fact we know about context-free grammars. I could prove it if I wanted to, but I won't bother. Namely, that in order to get the probability of the parse, we simply take the product of the probability of all the rules. So the question then becomes, okay, suppose we do this. Suppose we go through and we compute the probability of all the rules. We get a collection of possible parses for a sentence. We compute the probability of all those parses. How you do that isn't completely trivial, but I'm going to ignore that for the moment at least. How do we evaluate how well we've done? So we're going to produce a parse. We're going to then compare it against what's in the tree bank, and we're going to come out with a number. Since the most obvious number would just be, is it the same? Is the parse we got the same as the one in the tree bank? And if so, we could give ourselves a 1, and otherwise we'd give ourselves a 0, and the number we would get out would be, in effect, the percentage of times that the parse we got was, in fact, identical. Unfortunately, if we did that, we almost never get a parse 100% correct. Okay, that's just beyond our current capabilities. In fact, it's beyond human capabilities, since very often there's ambiguity, and the process is not completely well defined. So instead, what we do is we compute what's called labeled precision recall. So we will first say that every constituent consists of 3 pieces: a label, like noun phrase, a start point, such as this noun phrase starts in position 3 of the sentence, and a finish point, such as this noun phrase ends at position 8 in the sentence. Okay, so if you give me a parse, I can now create a set of such labels. And now I can also, if you give me the correct parse, I can create a set for it. And I now ask 2 questions. Let C be the number of correct constituents produced by the parser on the test set M. I'm sorry, on the test set. Let M be the total number of constituents produced, and N be the total number in the correct version. Then precision is C divided by M, and recall is C divided by N. So precision is, of all the constituents that I produced, what percentage of them were in the tree bank, i.e. were correct. Recall is, of all the constituents in the tree bank, what percentage of them did I find? Now, it's possible to artificially manipulate either precision or recall. So what we're in fact going to do is take the harmonic mean, which is of the two, which is called the F measure. Harmonic mean is essentially, well, it's, did I write it down? No. But at any rate, it's very, for our purposes, it's close enough to the average of the two that if you just think of the average, that will be working just fine. So let's suppose we did that. You take your tree bank sentences, feed them into a parser, evaluate the probability of all the possible parses, evaluate how well you're doing using the F measure of precision recall, and what do you get? The answer is you get about 75%. What that means is about 3 out of 4 constituents that you find are in fact correct, i.e. they have the correct label, they have the correct start point, they have the correct endpoint. Well, that's not terribly good, because that means one out of every four is wrong. And your average sentence, remember, is about 23 words in punctuation. So the average number of constituents is going to be maybe in the order of 18. So if the average number of constituents is in the order of, say, 16, then that means your average sentence is going to have four mistakes in it. That's not so great. So the question is, can we do better? And of course, the answer is yes, we can do significantly better. The way we typically do it is by something called lexicalization. In lexicalization, or lexicalized parsing, we condition not just on the kind of constituent, but also on what is called the head word, where the head word is the word which is the most important word for that kind of phrase. So for a verb phrase, the head word is the main verb. For a noun phrase, it's typically the rightmost noun in English, etc. For a prepositional phrase, we conventionally say that the head word is the preposition. So consider the following rules. What's the probability a verb phrase goes to verb, noun phrase, as in the salesman sold the dog biscuits? So where we've got a verb followed by two noun phrases in a row. And the answer is, if you look in the tree bank, the probability is 0.00151, which means that approximately one out of every 1,000 verb phrases has that particular form. I.e., not very many. Okay, so that's a fairly rare construction. Now, suppose I tell you, however, that the main verb of the sentence is the verb said. And now I ask, what's the probability now, given that it's said? And the answer is it's much, much lower. And the reason it's much, much lower is because the verb said in English doesn't take that kind of construction. And you might ask, why isn't it zero? And the answer is, it's not zero because my parser tries to avoid assigning anything a zero probability, because you never can be sure what English will dredge up and throw at you. Okay? So it always assigns some very small probability to even things which are ungrammatical, or which at least you think could never occur. And if you pressed me, I can produce some examples where said actually would have that kind of construction, but they're pretty unusual. Now, on the other hand, suppose I tell you that the main verb is give. Okay, as in Fred gave Sam a dog. Well, give often takes that kind of construction, and if you now look for just gave in particular, you find that the probability now, given that the head verb is gave, goes up to approximately 2%. Okay, so it's approximately 10 times the probability for all verbs in general, and approximately 10,000 times more likely than said. So what we're doing here, by conditioning the probabilities on the individual verbs, is making the probabilities much tighter, so that when the main verb is gave, it will be much more lenient in allowing an interpretation with two noun phrases. And when it's said, conversely, it will be much less lenient. We can also lexicalize the probabilities for the head. What do I mean by that? Well, if I happen to know that at a certain point in a sentence I've got a plural noun, what's the probability that that plural noun is the noun prices? And in the Wall Street Journal, it's pretty high. It's about 1%. So 1% of all the plural nouns in the Wall Street Journal is the word prices. Suppose I tell you that not only is this thing a plural noun, but it's also the subject of the sentence, i.e. that its parent is a, that it's also the head of a noun phrase. Well, that's what the second line here says, and that is, again, about the same. Suppose I tell you furthermore now that not only is it the head of a noun phrase, but it's also the subject, i.e. its parent is a sentence. Well, now the probability doubles, 2.5%. What that means is the prices in the Wall Street Journal do things. They're agents, as you might say, not patients. If I further tell you that the main verb of this sentence is a past tense verb, the probability doubles again. And if I tell you that the main verb is fell, now the probability is 0.146. And you can see, obviously, this is a very specialized corpus. Because of all the plural things that fall, 15% of them are prices. Okay? But these probabilities, again, allow us to sharpen our parser's guess. So now it's going to like the word prices as subjects of sentences, particularly when the main verb is fell or fall. So, the last 7 years have seen, actually probably by this point it's more like 10 years, this slide is out of date. The last 10 years has seen a rapid improvement in statistical parsers, i.e. parsers that work pretty much as the way I've just described it. And there are a large number of contributors to this literature. And so far what I've described is generic enough that you might roughly correspond to the work of any one of these authors. And if you look at the year-to-year improvement, about 1995 was the first of the modern statistical parsers. It was about 84% labeled precision recall. And by 1999, we had reached almost 90%, 89%. Okay. Starting about 99, however, things flattened out. And in fact, until 95, there were no significant improvements over a score of about 99%. And what I'm going to be telling you in the rest of this talk is how now we have pushed up this result quite significantly in the last 2 years or so. Okay, so the first improvement is dates back about 2 years ago. And what we're going to be describing is a coarse-defined n-best parsing and maxent discriminative re-ranking system. Let me tell you what that means. So far what I've been describing is you take a sentence, you analyze it, find possible parses, pick out the most likely, return that, and say, how did I do? Now I'm going to be describing a system where instead of finding the first best, it finds n best, where n is, say, like 50. So you find not the single best parse, but the 50 best, i.e., the 50 parses that have the 50 highest probabilities. And then you put it through a second system called a discriminative re-ranker. And the hope is that this so-called discriminative re-ranker is able to apply more fine-grained tests and re-rank the top 50. So, in particular, some of the time it will take what might be the second or third or fourth or 50th, and move it up to first. And then, after that's done, then you return what now is the first, and then you see how well you've done now. And the goal is to see if you can do this re-ranking such that now the first best is more often, has a higher score than what used to be the first best. Now, you can see that if you could do this in principle, you could improve things quite a bit. So consider the following result. Currently, given the parser I just described, if we take the first best, we get 89.7. Okay? Not quite 90%. If we look at the top two, and we had an oracle, if God came down and said, take that one, and God was always going to give us the correct answer, and we always chose that one, then we would, in fact, move up to 0.914. If we were able to choose between the 10 best and God came down and said, pick number 6 or whatever, then we'd get up to nearly 95%. And by 50 best, we'd be up to nearly 97%. And informally, 97% is probably about the limit of human abilities in this task, i.e. a well-trained person might be able to do about 97%. But there's no actual statistics on this. But that's sort of my guess, and that's probably reasonably accurate. So if we could possibly do this, and if we could do it perfectly, then we'd be getting up to, with the 50 best, we'd be getting up to human level performance. But of course, we can't do it perfectly. And the question is, can we do it better than we're currently doing? The answer is yes. We do it by a system called MaxEnt re-ranking. Well, I've already told you what re-ranking is, namely, it's simply the taking the current rank and changing it around. MaxEnt is simply a mathematical technique for applying sets of rules to allow us to do this re-ranking. So, in particular, suppose we have our n best parses. Y is a vector consisting of y1, which is the first best of the, for the sentence, y2 of s, which is the parse number 2 of the sentence, up to yn of s. So those are our parses. Next, I'm going to have a set of m features. What is a feature? A feature is a binary predicate of the form, say, this sentence has the rule in it, verb phrase goes to verb, noun phrase, noun phrase. And if the sentence has it, this feature has value 1. If otherwise, it has value 0. Actually, we're going to generalize that slightly. We're not going to restrict them to 0 and 1. If it has that rule in it twice, this feature would then have the value 2. So basically, there are just various patterns that we can see in the parse. And we're going to count how often each one of these patterns appears. Each pattern is going to have associated with it a weight in the vector m. I'm sorry, m weights, and that's in here. What are these weights? Well, some of these weights are going to be above, are going to be positive. And what that means is, if you see this pattern, it's more likely this is the correct parse. You should be more likely to think this is the correct parse than otherwise. And if this weight were negative, you would think the reverse. Namely, if you see this pattern, this parse is less likely to be the correct one. Okay? And for the moment, let's not worry about where you get these weights, but if you have these weights, then what you do is you take the value of the parse, which is just the inner product of the feature values times their weights, i.e., we sum up all the features times their weights, and we get a number. And if this number is very high, then we're going to re-rank this parse very highly, and if it's very low, we're going to re-rank it very poorly. Okay, and then we're just going to find the highest value parse according to that sum. Now, You might ask, why is this going to do any better? We already had a set of rules. Remember, we had all these probabilities for the various rules. Why is this going to do any better than that set of rules? And the answer is that we can make these patterns very, very specific. What do I mean? When we're given a sentence, a string of words, in general, as I said, we're going to need to consider something in the order of 10 to the 100th possible parses. That's an astronomical number. In fact, we know that it's possible to do this in very efficiently, okay, using dynamic programming, but only if we keep very simple kinds of probabilities, i.e., what's the probability of this rule, what's the probability of that rule. These features are much more general. So, for example, here is one feature schema. What are the number of constituents? I'm sorry, how many times do we see a constituent of length k? Is this constituent at the end of the sentence before a punctuation mark or neither? Okay, so this is a schema. So, for example, one instantiation of this schema would be there are 1,449 different, there are 1,049 different versions of this schema. For example, this parse has between two to four constituents of length 5 to 8 at the end of a sentence. Notice this is not the probability of any rule. This is just some arbitrary feature that we're looking at on the parse. And this feature is going to be either given a positive weight or a negative weight, and it might be higher or lower. And the way we do this, by the way, well, actually, I'll be talking about that in a second. So these features are much more general, and so we can encode information that we couldn't encode in our original rules. And so because of that, if we have good features, we might, therefore, capture regularities that previously we couldn't capture. So, if we look at this, there are 13 feature schema. They capture 1,141,000 blah, blah, blah different features that occur five or more times, each feature occurs five or more times. For any given parse, of course, almost all these 1 million will have value 0, and so we have to have very efficient indexing schemes by which, given a parse or a set of parses, we pull up the possible features that won't have value 0, and then we sum them all up. So where do we get these features, or how do we find their values? And the answer is, with some difficulty, what we do basically is we train our parser on a subset of the training data. So here, if you look, here's our full training data. It's about 38,000 words, say. Sorry, 38,000 sentences. We take 2,000 of those, and now we're going to pretend that those are our test sentences. And we take another 2,000, pretend they're our development sentences. Development is just used for setting some parameters. And then we pretend that the rest are our training data. And then we parse these 2,000. Okay, now this isn't a real test. We're not actually testing our parser. We're training our parser. Because once we compare the result we get using this training data on these examples, we can see how well our parser has done on every possible example. We look at the 50 best. And we look at our features. And we can say, this feature, did it occur? If not, we can ignore it. If it did occur, did it rank the correct parse, because we know the correct parse because this is part of our training data, did it rank our correct parse higher or lower than it should have? I.e., if it was the correct parse and it assigned a good high value, well, that's great, make it even higher. But if it was an incorrect parse and should assign a low value, well, let's make it even lower. So the point then is that we then proceed to adjust these weights on every single time we make a mistake to get them so that they rank the good parses highly, the bad parses poorly. Okay, and we do this. This is called cross-validation. And we basically do this 20 times. Each time we get 2,000 test sentences, and we continually improve our weights. Well, if we do this, we move from 89.5 to about 91.3. That may not seem like a great deal, but that's a 17% error reduction. Okay, so that means now that we're making 17% fewer mistakes than we were making before. Well, that's good. Furthermore, as I point out, in fact, it's higher than 17%. Why? Because people can't get 100%, so no one can get 100%. So probably the best you can do is probably somewhere around 97%. So in fact, this is a much higher percentage of the way to 97%. So we're making progress. Can we do better? And the answer is yes. And this is the new stuff now. Learning from unlabeled data. Any questions, by the way? Everyone's been quiet. Yeah. How do you choose the features? That is a black art. Okay. You use some intuition, and then you try different sets on the development corpus and see how well they do. And it's by no means, there's no easy way to do it because they combine in very strange ways. So, for example, you will get a set of features that you start with, say, some base set of features. You add a new set to it. Things get better. You remove that new set and take a different new set. Things get better. You add both of those two sets together, no better than either one by itself. Maybe slightly worse than either one by itself. I mean, you know, these things can just, you to a remarkable degree, they defy intuition. There are, if we were going to sit down one-on-one, I would tell you some basic knowledge that we know one set of features that is remarkably good, but it's still a black art. Other questions? Yes?
In terms of those intuitions, does it mean that you take into consideration rules and tendencies as well, or just the rules?
Rules and tendencies. So, for example, in English is a so-called right-branching language, which means that most constituents end at the right end of the sentence. That's a tendency. It's not a hard and fast rule. So that you may remember that feature I was talking about, it said what percentage of the constituents, how many constituents of a given length end at the right hand end of the sentence. That feature is a feature measuring a tendency. And so so high numbers there tend to have high values. Okay, but it's not a hard and fast rule. Other questions? Yeah.
How context-free is it after you apply these features? Or ultimately, how context-sensitive are these extra features that you're adding?
These extra features can be pretty context-sensitive. So the answer is a lot of the context-freeness has now gone away.
And is that why you think we're getting these games?
Yes. Well, also,
because there's discriminative training, which could also be part of it, meaning that you could go back, for example, that the Parquet's parser is MaxN. So I can imagine you could go back and train his parameters discriminatively.
Yeah.
There are two things at play. I'm not sure.
Yes, I'm not sure either. It's both. So now we're going to talk about something called self-training. So, previously, when we trained our data, we had the human-parsed Penn tree bank. There are only, as I said, about 1 million words of that, 40,000 sentences. Suppose we took the output of our parser, pretended it was correct, and fed it back into our parser as training data. That would be what's called self-training. It's called self-training because you're training on data that the parser itself produced. And the question is, can this help? So here's the basic paradigm again. So the basic paradigm is we train on a portion of the tree bank. We have a testing portion. We collect the statistics, feed those into now the parser re-ranker, and we test on the testing portion. Well, now we're also going to take some unlabeled text, some text that has not been parsed by humans, feed that into the parser, and we're going to get out some parser-produced results. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take those results, feed it back in as if they're part of the training data, and then gather our new statistics based on the combination of the two. Now, if you think about it, this seems very incestuous. Okay? Why should this work? I mean, you would think that, for example, the parser, when it gets this unlabeled data, is going to make all sorts of mistakes. And what you're going to be doing is you're going to be reinforcing the mistakes that it already has a tendency to make. And in fact, this is by far and away the conventional wisdom on this. And here's a quote. Nor does self-training offer a way out. This is offer a way out from the problem that we have so little human parsed sentences. Cherniak, 1997, showed a small improvement from training on 40 million words of its own output, probably because the increased size of the training set gave somewhat better counts for the head dependency models. Remember when we said, what's the probability of this word given that the head is that word? What's the probability of prices given fell? Well, that's what he's talking about here. However, training on data that merely confirms the parser's existing view cannot help in any other way, and one might expect such improvements to be transient and eventually to degrade in the face of otherwise noisy data. And that's from Steedman et al., 2002. And when this was written, I completely agreed with this sentiment that I had an earlier result that showed a trivial improvement, not enough, it wasn't even statistically significant, and the whole thing seemed pointless. However, suppose you don't take my word for it, and you try it anyway. How might you go about doing it? Well, we, in particular Dave McCloskey back there, parsed and re-ranked 400 million words of the North American news corpus, and from that, we took 20 million words from the Los Angeles Times to add as training data. Okay, so this is re-ranked, I'm sorry, this is reparsed or parsed data that was not humanly parsed, but rather parsed by our machine. Okay? Using this data in combination with our regular training data, we now parse section 23 of the Penn Tree Bank as before, and lo and behold, we get an improvement. So let's refresh our memory. The first line here is 89.5. That's where we were 2 years ago. The second line is the 91.3 number I mentioned for the re-ranker. Okay, so that was as of 2005. And then this last year, when David added 40 million words of Los Angeles Times data to the mix, it went up to 92.1. Now, given that everyone knew that this wouldn't work, why is it working? And this is an ongoing source of debate, and the short answer is, I don't know. Okay? There have been many suggestions. Some of them we have actually tested. None of the ones that we've tested have proven correct. Okay, so it's still a mystery, but we got an improvement. And as we will see, this improvement is fairly robust. So this is just on the Wall Street Journal again. So now we have an error reduction, not of 17%, but now we're up to a 25% error reduction. And so we're getting very, very good performance at this point. So as I said, we don't know why. Now, finally, I don't know, actually I've got lots of time, but maybe we'll end early. What happens if we don't look at the Penn Tree Bank and instead look at a different corpus, like the Brown corpus? Okay, as Martha Palmer commented, this is all very tree bank. Oh, there you are. This is all very tree bank, Wall Street Journal specific. What happens if you move away from the Wall Street Journal? And the answer is, things go very badly. So if you, instead of trying to parse the Wall Street Journal, you try to parse the Brown corpus, instead of getting 89% or 92% or whatever, you get 83.9%, 84%. Much, much worse. Okay? And as you may remember, the Brown corpus was developed by Henry Kutra, and it's a so-called balanced corpus. It consists of about 1 million words of text from 1961. It has newspapers, novels, religious articles, etc. And the fact that we do so badly might indicate that our parsers are sort of like overbred racehorses. Namely, they do very well on turf, but if you have to, turf is the sort of artificial dirt that you put in on racetracks. But they do very badly when you give them things outside their very natural, unnatural domain. Well, turns out that you might think that this new stuff, which still trains on even more data and does even better on the Wall Street Journal, might make things even worse, more overtrained. But in fact, it's just the opposite. So here are some statistics. As I said, if you take my basic parser and apply it to Wall Street Journal, you get 89.5. That was the 3 years ago, or actually now, that result goes all the way back to about 2000. Again, you take that parser, apply it now to Brown, you get 83.9. However, if you take the re-ranking parser, which looks even more deeply at WSJ, and apply it to Brown, okay, this is, you get 85.8. Now, remember This is with no Brown training data. This is just Wall Street Journal training data and re-ranking. So it has not seen any of the actual Brown trees. But now it's gone from 83.9 to 85.8. And furthermore, and this is, you know, to my mind, just astounding, if you now add the 40 million words that were produced using the Wall Street Journal parser, and you add them to the mix, you now go up to 87.7. So instead of getting worse, things are getting much, much better. I mean, we're not yet doing as well on Brown as we're doing on the Wall Street Journal, but the percentage improvement, again, has been about 25%. Okay, so that I find very encouraging, because the standard wisdom about statistical parsers is that they work very well in the Wall Street Journal, but, you know, when you move away, things die. Well, they don't die, they don't do quite as well anymore, as they don't do quite as well, but they certainly don't die anymore. Okay, so what's next? Well, in fact, there are many things you can do next. What I'm actually doing these days, and what I'm actually going to talk about in my next lecture, has nothing to do with parsing. I'm actually going to talk about discourse analysis, which is not something I'm known for, but which I'm now finding very interesting. But if you are thinking about parsing, there's all sorts of very interesting things to do. In this domain, in this sort of region, you might start asking, does it matter that when we reparsed some new data, when we parsed some new data, it was from the Los Angeles Times? So the Los Angeles Times is sort of like the Wall Street Journal, but somewhat different. So maybe that's what's helping us with Brown. Okay, that strikes me as very plausible. So you can think then of the Los Angeles Times as what might be called a bridging corpus. Namely, it builds a bridge from the Wall Street Journal to Brown. It's sort of halfway in between. Brown, as you may remember, has all sorts of things like novels that are very far away from the Wall Street Journal. Los Angeles Times isn't the Wall Street Journal, but it's much more like the Wall Street Journal than, say, a novel. So then you might start asking, well, are there other ways we could use bridging corpora? So if you wanted to parse medical journals, maybe the way to do it is to first train on a biology textbook. I don't know. Seems way out. I think the odds of this working are small, but if it did work, brother, that would be very interesting. More generally, there's all sorts of new things happening in parsing these days. And I won't have time to go into it. Another one of my students back there, Will Hedden, is working on how you can automatically learn to parse different kinds of noun phrases and different kinds of verb phrases. Okay, so automatically realizing, say, that a noun phrase that consists of all proper nouns looks very different from a noun phrase with a determiner in front of it, say. I'm making this up. But it would learn this automatically. I think that's another very interesting topic. More generally, in conclusion, rather, we've improved in parsing a lot. There are lots of things to do in the future. And thank you. And questions? Lunch. Yeah. Right.
You said that we have 400 million words available.
Yes.
And then out of
Yes.
Section. How did you arrive at that choice? Okay,
I think you'll ask, I think David probably should be the one to answer that. My understanding was that it was just sort of just random, just in particular, David's nodding his head. It was just an arbitrary choice. The one thing we didn't want to do is pick Wall Street Journal because we didn't want to have accidental contamination in case there was part of the test data in it, which shouldn't have occurred, but we were super cautious. So we didn't want to take Wall Street Journal. Anything else would have been fine, and we just picked arbitrarily Los Angeles Times. We can come back to you. There's someone in back first, and then I'll come back to you.
Continuation of that. So I was wondering, you have looked at different possible explanations. I'm sure you have looked at this one, and I was just wondering why it's wrong. So is it just a question of size? I don't know. What would have happened if you had used the entire 400 million words? So did you try it?
Yes. David went up to, I think, 10 times this size? Right. I mean, we stopped seeing any improvement at this point, but we tried much larger. Okay. Oh, just a little bit larger? Okay. But, yeah, who knows? I mean, we didn't see any improvement when we went beyond this size. But maybe if we went really, really, really beyond this size, we would start seeing improvement again. Don't know. I mean, after a while, at some point, the experiments, of course, get harder and harder to conduct. The parser still works reasonably well, even with this amount of data. But just loading the parser up to start the experiment begins to take significant amounts of time. So, Chiprian, did you have another?
That was
actually... Oh, okay. I don't know what MST parsing is. So. Maximum spanning trees? Ah, yes. I find that stuff very interesting. As of yet, basically the advantage of maximum spanning tree parsing, in particular, I guess I'm thinking of the work of... what's his name? Ryan McDonald. Thank you. It's very fast. And I gather can be made even faster. So from a viewpoint of speed, it, I think can be made to work like 10 or 100 times faster than my parser. Right now, Ryan's program is like 4 times faster. But it's written in Java, and mine's written in C. So, I've got probably just rewriting it in C would give you another factor of 2, okay? So it's very fast. It's not as accurate, okay? So the current program is about, 91%, but that's not measuring labeled precision recall. It's measuring... dependencies. And lastly, at least so far, it only works on dependency parsing. It doesn't work on full tree parsing. I think it is definitely worth exploring because the speed is such that it makes parsing... I mean, one of my goals in all this is to make parsing a utility, just like running water that you don't even have to think about. Okay, you just parse just the way you would tokenize or whatever, and you don't have to think about, am I going to do it, is it worthwhile, etc. Well, with my parser, it takes about a second a sentence, maybe slightly less, to parse a sentence. With Ryan's, you're down to a quarter of a second, and... I think without very much trouble, you could probably bring that down to 1/100 of a second. At 1/100 of a second a sentence, who cares, you know? I mean, that's just no time at all. So just the speed makes me think that it's worth pursuing. But as of yet, it's not as accurate, and it doesn't give you the full trees. Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of related issues that come up with recognition used to have to do with statistical learning and not necessarily with parsing. So if you had to parse the Wall Street Journal, and if you had a choice of having 40,000 sentences of Wall Street Journal to train on versus 1,000 sentences each from 40 different corpora to train on, then the speech recognition the analogy says you should train on the 40 different sources rather than one of them.
If you're going to be tested on some unknown.
So if you're going to parse ground, the ground corpus,
right,
then you should certainly train on many different things.
That's right.
Right. So now, of course, nobody's going to give us another pre-bank of 40 different genera.
Right.
But there is one part that seems very doable, which is that your discriminative training set only has a small portion, right? It's sort of a couple of thousand sets. Or do you iterate through all of
them? No, we iterate. That's
because I think that even something very simple, like having 1,000 sentences from the LA Times to do the discriminative pre-ranking, sort of the training the discriminative component might take.
I've seen some results to that effect, actually, that says that if you've got a small additional amount of data, using it discriminatively is a very good way of using it. Yes?
Yeah, that's one thing. And the other insight is that, in general, discriminative methods are more robust than generative methods, in the sense that...
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, so this is just a generic feeling. I don't think there's a theorem out there.
Right.
So. But that's another reason why the discriminative methods are doing better on the ground corpus, namely that they are not...
Yes. Right.
Probably the reason for it, and that also argues for discriminative training of the original parser itself. If you could do it, rather than doing maximum accurate counts, you could go back and look at a discriminative way of estimating probability.
We actually did a little bit of that,
right.
But I think it's sufficiently complex that we ought to take it offline.
Okay.
Anyway, the quick answer is, we did not get any improvement. On Wall Street Journal.
The thing is, it might actually have been on the brown.
We haven't tried it on the brown corpus. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.